The Theosophical Society presents Mr. James Perkins in a talk entitled Reincarnation for Everyone.
And audiences have been increasingly interested in this subject of reincarnation. And we have felt, some of us who have been longer students of this knowledge, that it would be a good time for us to explain as concisely and as simply as we can the theosophical concept of reincarnation, in the hopes that this will clear up some of the misconceptions about this great knowledge. I've been hearing the strangest things, comparisons made. Someone said the other day that this knowledge could be compared to witchcraft. I don't know how they got those two tied up together. But the notion seems to be general that reincarnation is a superstitious idea that is held by ignorant people, particularly people who happen to live in the Orient. Now, we ought to be reminded that reincarnation was a worldwide idea in ancient times, and it's a worldwide idea in modern times. Certainly over half of the people in this world hold this idea of reincarnation to be true in some form or other. And I wouldn't be at all surprised that if we could take an actual poll of the subject of the people of this world, we would be amazed to learn what a large percentage of the population of the world's people hold to this idea somewhere in the background of their thinking. It's interesting to remember that when the civilizations of Egypt and India, China, Persia, Babylon, Greece, and Rome were the leading civilizations of the world, the idea was prevalent in those days. And if we think that reincarnation is some kind of a gross pagan doctrine of unenlightened minds, doesn't it give you pause to recall that Plato, Plutarch, Pythagoras, Socrates, Virgil, Plotinus, and a long list of such men, leading men of that day, men from whose minds have stemmed some of the greatest ideas and cultural treasures, mental treasures that we have received as our heritage from the past. Men like these held this idea of reincarnation. Or if you come closer down to historical times, to men whose thinking has had some of the greatest influence upon our Western civilization, I mean men like Francis Bacon, Dante, Shakespeare, Schopenhauer, Bruno, Goethe, Maeterlinck, Huxley, and a long list of those such men, but were believers in reincarnation. And nearly all of the major poets of the 19th century were proponents of this idea, including Hawthorne, Tennyson, Keats, Kipling, Longfellow, Whitman, Whittier, Wordsworth, and many others. And when you turn to the practical geniuses who made America great, you find that among the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin was an outspoken reincarnationist, and another who did more than anyone else to put into our language the practical American philosophy. I mean Ralph Waldo Emerson was a protagonist of reincarnation, and that other great man whose genius led the way in giving the world more light and power in all the visual and audio enjoyments that we experience today, I mean Thomas A. Edison, was a believer in reincarnation, and I shall add, a member of the Theosophical Society. And Henry Ford, who put the population on wheels, so to speak, said in a published article, "When I discovered reincarnation, it was as if I had found a universal plan. Reincarnation put my mind at ease. I felt that order and progress were present in the mystery of life. I no longer looked elsewhere for a solution to the riddle of life, and I would like to communicate to others the calmness that this long view of life gives to me." Words of Henry Ford. And let me not forget, in making this list, the man who gave us the greatest game in America, I mean baseball, General Abner Doubleday, not only believed in reincarnation, but as a member of the Theosophical Society, he helped to promote the dissemination of this truth. So you see, friends, if you are attracted to the idea yourself, you're in respectable company. I myself believe in it. I would like to make it clear, though, at the outset, seriously, I was raised a Christian, and I have given attention all my life to religious ideas and concepts, and I entertain this idea of reincarnation in the framework of Christian thought, and in all logic and reason, I see no other way in which to receive the message of Jesus Christ except in the light of reincarnation. You see, reincarnation is fundamentally a religious idea. It appeared in the background or in the direct teachings of all the world religions, and certainly it was entertained in the thinking of those people among whom Christianity came to birth. I mean the Essenes, the Gnostics, the Manichaeans, and all of those people at that time held this idea to be true with regard to man's situation on earth. And Jesus himself refers to reincarnation in some of the passages in the scriptures, in the books of the New Testament. You have to remember in thinking of this that religious teachers teach within the commonly accepted ideas of their day. Now, Jesus was concerned with teaching those eternal spiritual verities that are to be taught if the soul is to find its way to perfection, to the fulfillment of God's injunction that we should be perfect as he is in heaven. Now, Jesus didn't teach reincarnation. He didn't have to. It was a general accepted idea of the day, generally accepted. There is a revealing episode in the books of the New Testament, one that I think points directly to this matter. And as we have it in the 9th chapter of Luke, there we see one day Jesus is sitting there talking to his disciples. And I can almost see the twinkle in his eye as he asks, "Whom say the people that I am?" And they answered, saying, "John the Baptist, but some say Elias, and others say that one of the prophets is risen again." Now that phrase, risen again, is a synonym for the word reincarnation. And there they are, talking in the language, in the framework of the ideas of their day, speculating, if you will, upon whom Jesus might be the reincarnation of. Then there was that other occasion when Jesus was descending the mountain after his transfiguration before Peter, James, and John, where he admonished them to say nothing about his coming death as the Son of Man. Now, they had beheld the vision in all its glory. They knew they were in the presence of the Messiah. No question about that. But they were also conversant with the ancient prophecy that before Elias, before Jesus or the Messiah appeared, Elias would return. And so, bewildered, they asked the Master, "But why? Why do the scribes expect first to see Elias?" And Jesus said, "But I say unto you that Elias is come already, and they knew him not." And they understood that he spoke of John the Baptist. Those are the words, as you have them in Matthew, 17th chapter, you remember. Now, what is he saying? They understood he spoke of John the Baptist. That Elias had reincarnated as John the Baptist. Do you see the implication? Here's a new personality entirely. But it's Elias returned. That's what he's saying. And then you'll remember that Jesus stated publicly and in no uncertain words, "And if ye will receive it, this is Elias which was for to come. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear." That passage always interests me because it tells us that there are just as many people in those days as there are in these days who hear only what they want to hear. People always listen for only what they want to hear. But there have been, there always have been, and they are now, people who are becoming sensitive with that sensitiveness of the inner self that listens and hears the spiritual meaning behind the outer words and the outer message. It ought also to be remembered in this connection that reincarnation was eliminated from the Christian discourse by theologians in later centuries and elsewhere than in Palestine, 500 years later, to be exact, because it was in the 6th century at those councils of Constantinople where, under pressure of theologians, this doctrine was ousted from the Christian discourse. And it was in one of these councils that the anathema was pronounced in these words: "Whosoever shall teach the preexistence of the soul and the strange opinion of its return to earth, let him be anathema." Now, you know what that means? Excommunicated with curses. Now, with that kind of heat turned on, who's going to go around and talk about reincarnation? The whole matter was dropped. And so, with this repudiation of the doctrine by the church, and with the disappearance of the mystery schools, wherein reincarnation had been taught for thousands and thousands of years back into the night of time, with the disappearance of these mystery schools, reincarnation was lost to the Western thought for 1,000 years. Now, I can see that as a good thing for the progress of man in certain respects, for this state of affairs seemed to be necessary in view of what was preparing in Europe. A new civilization was about to get started. Coming to birth was a new approach to truth. I mean experimental science. And we can point to Roger Bacon as truly the founder, for not only did he carry on his experiments in a laboratory, but he preached a doctrine: believe nothing, prove everything. Sounds like the 20th century, doesn't it? Well, it was the 13th century, and it was rank heresy, and he spent 14 years in the dungeons for it. Now, you see, with this idea of reincarnation held in the background during the birth period of Western civilization, the thinking of Western man became focused upon this single life. And that gave drive to Western civilization, to men to conquer and organize physical nature. And that's what's still going on, you see. In due time, the ancient learning began to seep back into European thought, and I think we can point to those Moorish invasions across North Africa and into Spain, for they brought with them the Arabian and Persian culture, and there were universities in Spain as early as 800 A.D., and the influence of this learning spread to Paris as far as that, and it was from those sources, and particularly in Paris, that Roger Bacon gained his information and his inspiration for turning this new way, this new approach to truth. So you see, the scientific method got underway, embattled by theology, given a good shove ahead by the coming of the geniuses of the Renaissance, and in a couple of centuries later, when democracy was established, freeing men to think and experiment as they pleased, science began to put its roots down and to grow and flourish as the Western mode of the approach to truth. And so I would say that it reached its fulfillment, its full flowering in the 19th century with the positivistic thinkers, wherein they produced an absolutely mechanical version of man and the universe, providing thereby a perfect atmosphere for the appearance of dialectical materialism. Now you see, this materialistic view of man's position in the universe and of the universe itself is the direct antithesis of the spiritual interpretation and explanation of man's purpose in being. And so we see these two antagonistic. Now, I'm saying all this so that I can say that in 1875 there occurred one of the most significant events of our time, with the founding of the Theosophical Society by great adepts of the wisdom, the ancient wisdom of mankind, which is an accumulative wisdom that has been assembled down through the ages regarding man and the universe. The founding of the Theosophical Society was intended to speed up the appearance of this ancient wisdom in Western thought. And the impact of theosophy has been to meet materialism on its own ground of deductive science, logic, and reason, creating a rapprochement between science and religion, a development that has continued down through these decades, and I think was the original impulse that gave life to this spreading interest in religion that we see spreading all over the world today. There is an increasing interest in religion, not necessarily in churches, but in religion and religious questions. I think this is good, and let us hope that the religions of the world will sustain this growth by opening wide their doors of conceptualization to wider horizons for the questing minds, because the religions of the West need the return of the great ideas of the ancient wisdom, the ideas of the spiraling evolution of the soul to perfection through this reincarnation process. Christianity needs reincarnation, for terrible questions are being asked and forced upon us by the events of these days, questions that cannot be answered either by the materialistic version of life or by this one life interpretation and then heaven or hell forever. There's the ever-pressing query, for example, if God exists and God is all-merciful and all-powerful, why is there so much misery in the world? Why so many undeserved opportunities and so much undeserved suffering and misery? Is it just blind chance that one man gets up before the television program and answers a $64 question while 64,000, I must correct myself, while another man at the same time hears about five of his six children succumbing to polio at the same time? I say, is this just blind chance? And we have questions like this all around us every day. Now, these are obvious questions that anyone might ask, but I think we come to grips with the full significance of our plight today in the far more meaningful question, why, if God is all-merciful, all-loving, and all-powerful, why has man been permitted to explore the secrets of the universe to release cosmic forces that can be used for the destruction of all living creatures while man himself remains morally, ethically, and spiritually so immature that he reverts easily and naturally to violence to secure his ends and to solve his problems? Well, we're right up against the terrible situation where we see nations of the world drawing up into two armed camps, each arming with swiftly as possible with these fearful new weapons that will soon become atom-powered intercontinental missiles with hydrogen bomb warheads. Are the nations marching toward ultimate catastrophe? Is the human race to disappear in a Holocaust beyond description? Aren't you asking such questions yourselves? For we're marching in that direction. And in our human extremity, is it not permissible to ask, where is God in all this, if he be all-merciful and all-powerful? Surely, God is present in some mysterious way beyond ordinary comprehension. But haven't we to look more closely? Is it not time to realize more certainly the nature of man, the nature of the universe, and the eternal principles of order, the laws that guide our destinies, such as this law of reincarnation, the plan itself, so that we may begin to cooperate more fully with the plan? Perhaps we are not cooperating well enough, and the time has come for fuller cooperation, and we need knowledge. Now, the other day, one of the Christian pastors in Chicago stated that this doctrine of reincarnation denies the creation of the soul and the eternal salvation God has ordained for it. But we who are students know that reincarnation does not deny salvation. It presents an even grander revelation of the scriptural references to the soul's creation and salvation. And it's in this picture of the soul's evolution through a series of lives not salvation, but liberation. Not some peak of salvation that sets us apart from everybody else, but liberation straight into the heart of things, the perfect mastery of our environment and of ourselves. God's ordainment about the saved man is that he shall become perfect. But does anyone become perfect in one life on earth? Have you ever seen anyone who did? Did you ever hear of anyone who became perfect in one life? How illogical it is to assume that we have only this one life on earth. How utterly purposeless this short life is if it isn't some part of a whole plan of fulfillment. If you imagine for a moment the millions and millions of people who live out terrible lives, living in the most awful circumstances and confined to the harshest labor, burdened and ill, eking out a weary existence to end before their time. Are none of these souls, we may ask, ever to know great vision and great growth through their own effort? Are they never to experience the joyous release that even the painter and the musician and the poet know in these days? Are they never to achieve the serene power of the liberated mind and the unconquered spirit? But with reincarnation, there are many lives to know all these things. And the shortest and most unlovely life has meaning. For there is time, not just for one existence, however painful that may be, of a few years, and then death, and then this very questionable hereafter. The idea of reincarnation, rather, opens the wider horizons of the soul, the long vista toward knowledge, toward illumination, toward mastery of self and environment, yes, toward perfection. For if there is this eternal being within us, this eternal self, which is secure in its citadel, the immortal soul, which cannot be destroyed, whatever the vicissitudes of life, and which is steadily unfolding its divine powers through whatever experience befalls us, then this world of sorrow makes sense, doesn't it? And we find ourselves living in a universe of law and order, God's beneficence enfolding us. And thus, knowing his law, the universal order, we can cooperate with his plan, and every experience has meaning. Every life has meaning, and we can work out our own salvation as we look eagerly to the great teachers, the great masters of life. And the story of Jesus inspires us, but so likewise can the story of Krishna and Buddha, of Confucius and Mohammed, and of all the great teachers who have appeared among mankind. They can all inspire us and aid us to move along this pathway to liberation and perfection. And we can be thankful, too, for the great teachers who are yet to come out there in the future ahead of us, glad that there are these many ways home to God, ways of religion, of science, of art, of philosophy, the ways of business, of government, of home building, of sports, yes, all the ways in which we build character and unfold the latent powers of the soul. Now I'd like to draw your attention to this word reincarnation. It's a word of recent origin. It was invented by Madame Blavatsky herself, one of the founders of the Theosophical Society. It exists in four parts. Re, meaning back again, in, meaning in, carn, C-A-R-N, from that Latin word, meaning flesh, and shun, T-I-O-N, meaning the act of. Therefore, literally, the act of being back again in flesh, implying we've been here before, we've been somewhere else, we're back again. An orderly process. It replaces older words, rebirth, resurrection, palingenesis, arisen from the dead, risen again, and that other word, metempsychosis, which refers to an ancient and very subtle Egyptian doctrine I won't go into here, but which means and is understood to mean immediate passage at death into another body, not a synonym of reincarnation, if we mean reincarnation. So likewise, that other word, transmigration, often used as a synonym of reincarnation. That word is from the two words trans, meaning over, migrare, meaning to migrate from one country to another, from one body to another, whether it be human, animal, insect, or inanimate. Transmigration is a purposeless, endless wheel of birth and death without reason, without any purpose to it, non-cyclic, non-rhythmic, and therefore non-thinkable. Transmigration is not a synonym for reincarnation, despite Mr. Webster, if we mean reincarnation. Now you see, every great law of life is exemplified over and over in nature, in the natural order of things. Rhythm is an eternal principle, a universal principle. It's everywhere in evidence. It means cycles, push, pull across a dead center. You have it in your automobile engine. Nothing continues to move that is not rhythmic, and conversely, that which is rhythmic can continue to move. Life moves eternally, therefore rhythmic. From the source to the manifestation, from the manifestation to the source, and back again. So you see, reincarnation for humanity is a manifestation of this principle of rhythm that is everywhere throughout the universe. And if you didn't have the notion of reincarnation, you'd have to posit it, because if you are examining and exploring and investigating the truth of life all about you, you would come upon this evidence everywhere of the principle of rhythm, and it must therefore appear in our lives too. Reincarnation is an explanation of that principle as it acts in our lives. Now, the fundamental idea to be grasped is that life emerges from within. It comes from an inner source to appear out here in this outer manifestation. And so it continues out here for a time and withdraws to the inner source. We have to keep that in mind. There is a life consciousness at the heart of every living being. And this life consciousness, this unit of consciousness, is what is evolving. It contains the possibility of responding to every vibration that can reach it from the external world. And so we live out here in these bodies. We experience something in the outer world. The vibrations impinge upon the outer physical sensory equipment. These are transmitted inward through the subtler regions to the central intelligence, and there the impact is felt. There is a response. This response is growth. Now that is a continuous process, not only out here in the physical body, but also in the subtler inner realms of existence. So grasp that idea of the outer impact striking upon this central intelligence through all this mechanism, and the response going out, and that response is growth. Now if you add to that the second idea that this process is taking place rhythmically, eternally, you see, of life dipping into form to receive this experience and thus to respond to it and grow, and returning inward, regressing inward to come outward again, then you have grasped the great concept of reincarnation. It has purpose, it has meaning, it has destiny. The implication of reincarnation is that the real inner self is imperishable. There is a thinking principle in there that is perceiving, that is discerning, that is choosing, and that survives the dissolution of the physical body and continues the learning process in this inward cycle, which is much longer, that part of the cycle, than the outer part that we spend here in physical bodies. You see, 50, 60, 70 years out here, 1,000 years or more in there. So that learning process goes on all the way back to the source, and then we're ready for the return, reincarnation. Now, let's have a look at this theosophical picture of reincarnation. I think that theosophy gives us the most comprehensive and thoroughly integrated presentation of the knowledge of reincarnation that exists anywhere. in its concept of the reincarnating ego, or soul, if you will, that comes forth in these three vehicles, bodies, or coats of skin, if you will. Put it poetically, three coats of skin. I like to think of it that way myself. First, if we think of the outer one, here it is, physical body. We're in it. There's no argument there, is there? We know we're in the physical body. We may not be so much aware that this physical body has a finer counterpart that theosophists call the etheric double. Now, this is a kind of an atomic sheath, if you will, through which these impacts from the outer world striking upon the sensory equipment are transmitted inward to the central intelligence. That finer body has to be there. This is a very important part of the outer physical vehicle at the time of death, as I shall explain Sunday night. This etheric body or etheric double of the physical body, because it isn't actually a body itself, it has the shape of the physical body, it looks like the physical body, it's an exact counterpart. It's a sheath around every nerve, every tissue, permeates every nerve and tissue, and along it courses the vitality of the physical body, without which we wouldn't be alive. It's important that we know more about that physical, that etheric part of our physical body, because it has direct bearing upon our physical health. And we would be wise to learn a little bit about it. It can be seen by clairvoyance as everyone who has sensitized his sight just a little bit has been able to testify. A kind of a violet-gray or blue-gray radiation around the body, representing the health, the status of health of the physical body. Now I say these two together, the etheric double and the physical body, represent the first, the outermost, the densest, the coarsest vehicle or coat of skin. Now we come inward to the next, which is the astral, called astral by theosophists, simply because if you look at it clairvoyantly here in the physical body, you will see it as a kind of a luminous body enveloping, or shape enveloping the whole physical body, and it is of that finer texture of matter, that subtler vibration of matter, which is the next level of consciousness, and has been named astral simply because of its luminous appearance. Now, we are sitting here right now vibrating in that astral body. How are you feeling? Are you feeling happy? Are you feeling uncomfortable? Are you feeling anything, whatever you're feeling? You're feeling it with your consciousness focused at the energy level, which we call astral. One or another of the sub-levels of that energy level called astral. Meaning consciousness is feeling. Now, at death, of course, we are focused in that body. And though right now it may seem insubstantial to you as I talk about it this way, with consciousness focused there, it is just as substantial as this furniture is to us out here in our physical bodies. We go there when we die. It's a wonderful and a beautiful place. I'm going to enjoy saying a few things about Sunday night. But in that place, called by our good friends, the spiritualists, Summerland, referred to it that way, which I think is a rather nice title because it's a happy place for most people. Of course, if you're digging back to earth and clinging and clutching to things, you can't take them with you, you know, but people do try. If you're doing that, then the astral plane can be an unhappy and a limiting existence for that period of time, if you continue to be so, I don't like to use the word, but how stupid can we be? But if you turn and move into the light and upward into the subtler regions, just think, the astral plane is a place where you can be creative, just as creative as you want to be. A wonderful place. So we're there for a longer or shorter period, depending upon this earthy part of us that we are disenthralling ourselves from, you see. We are moving through into the more ethereal states of being, and all this business out here is becoming more dreamy and hazy and is forgotten and left behind as we move into the higher realms of the astral life, preparing for that second stage, which has been referred to as the second death, where we fall asleep on the astral plane to wake up in the next level, the next energy level, which is mental. Now, I call these energy levels, they've been referred to as planes, astral plane, mental plane. But they're merely the energy levels of stepping up consciousness. If I come down here and pinch myself, my consciousness is focused in the physical sensory equipment. But if I feel, I'm feeling with my astral. It's another level. If I think, I'm up in my mental. If we're thinking right now about, are we going to get something to eat when we leave here tonight? Or what'll I wear tomorrow? Or do I have to ride that bus again? These kind of things, creating forms with the mental body. We are actually existing in the mental body. But when you pass on into those inner worlds at death, and you've left the physical, you've left the astral, and you're in that mental world, it's a very wonderful place indeed. It isn't just a little mental world you're thinking with now, but it opens out into what is called the heaven world. And there you take into that world all that lives spiritually in you. Anything has to do with beauty, anything of love, and all of the outgoing giving quality of you, which is spiritual, you see, the unifying quality in you, all of that you take with you into the heaven world. Some of us taking great riches because we're pouring ourselves out into the life around us and receiving some of that downflow that it can pour out through us. And in that way, preparing, I would say, for a wonderful time in the heaven world. Now, you're there for a longer time, a much longer time. You may have been 10, 15, even 20 or 25 years on the astral plane. Some people get stuck there 100 years, but you don't have to, you know. And then into the heaven world, where you are for 1,000, 1,500 years, for people who are searching truth, as all of us are here, and trying to live decent, orderly lives, and who are educated, who think about the spiritual side of things, all of us will be there for a long period, and we can certainly say 1,000 or more years. So then we go on through that, and we come to the other side of that, because at last we're through with all that we have brought there with us. Now we leave behind that mental world, that heaven world, and enter the inmost deathless sanctuary, the home of the soul, the real man, where he resides, the immortal thinker, the reincarnating ego. Now he is as a god looking forward and backward in time, seeing the plan and what is for him in this coming life, ready to try himself in the abyss down here below, the abyss of forgetfulness. And so he plunges downward. This is the moment of reincarnation. That's when it starts. Now, as I look at this picture, I think we've got to see ourselves right side up. We have been taught to look at ourselves upside down by every evidence around us, or that which is presented to us as evidence, upside down. We think the physical body is the be-all and end-all of existence. We have a soul. It's somewhere. Is it in my heart? Is it in my brain? Is it in my stomach? Wherever it is, the soul. And as for the imperishable spirit, well, some people talk about it. It remains to be seen. Now, isn't that the case with most people around us? That's upside down. The right side, we've got to see it this way. We are the imperishable spirit dwelling in the immortal soul which doesn't die, which is growing up to the fullness of the stature of godhood. How? By having experiences over and over and over again in this rhythmic appearance into physical forms, physical human forms, having experience down here, awakening the soul qualities, the soul growing to the fullness of the spiritual stature. And that's how we awaken in time, through long ages of experience and growth, our divinity. That's right side up. I think of our situation as that of an artist so often. Here he is, the painter who's painting a portrait, let us say. He starts off and he stretches this nice new white canvas on a frame, puts it up there on the easel. Nothing like this delicious moment of just getting ready to start a portrait. And so he begins to paint this portrait of a personality. It's just as though the soul is coming down here, born in this little baby body, getting ready now to start building a new personality. Not only the little body, but the feelings and the thoughts and everything as well. And pouring himself into it. in due time. So the painter gets off. If he gets off to a good start, everything goes along famously. Then finally he gets the painting completed. He sets it over there against the wall. He isn't the canvas. He isn't the paint. He's poured himself out in it. He's learned a lot from it. He's gained from it. But he is the eternal creator to go on painting other portraits in the future. He can walk over there in the corner and look through these old canvases and pick this one out and think how wonderful that was. What a grand experience. That other one, how I enjoyed doing that. The next one, well, we'd better leave it turned to the wall. Pretty awful mess. And so on. Just like the soul. Creating a personality here. James S. Perkins this time, something else some other time. But the eternal soul is not this, not that, not all these transient things down here. But rather, he is the eternal creator with infinite powers of productivity. And so it goes. And the soul may look back over his past lives in just that same objectivity. He's poured himself out into this personality, into that other which he lived long ago. Some of them he gained a lot from. Some of them just were tedious, toilsome, and awful experiences out of which he had to learn certain lessons, to develop certain strength, to release himself from old things that kept him down. So the soul is gathering these experiences of earth lives through which he's passed, and he's storing the accumulated treasures of knowledge, and here he is transmuting this knowledge by his own divine alchemy into that essence of experience and knowledge which is wisdom. So you see, wisdom is the fruitage of many lives. Now the big question, how is this cumulative wisdom made available to us now? That we want to know. Through memory. Memory. Not direct memory of details. Let me illustrate by taking a hypothetical case. Let us suppose, here's a soul born 2,500 years ago in Rome, let us say, named Marcus. Now he's born into this Roman heritage, which is one for organizing practical affairs, the drive to get things done. He develops this ability to organize and administer large affairs, lives out that kind of a life, developing a strong individuality, passes away to be born centuries later in India, let us say, named Krishna. Here he has a racial heredity of devotion, of mystical rapport with nature, of love for metaphysics. Now he's brought with him from that Roman life a faculty for organizing this energy he has. And so he organizes this spiritual interest he has in life and would naturally then create mental forms of beauty and truth and lives out a very happy and lovely life as a metaphysician and philosopher, let us say, to pass away and be born centuries later, let us say, in Russia, as a woman this time, named Helena. Now his physical heredity is that of active dynamism, of passionate love of life, of will to dominate environment, and let us add, a love of music. And so he has brought from India this metaphysical thing in his soul, and he has brought from Rome this organizing faculty in his soul. It is applied to this life of interest in music. She becomes a great musician and lives out a full life of that kind. To die and be born, let us say, in the United States as John Swift. Now his soul heredity is from Rome, organization, from India, mysticism, from Russia, art, and as a young man in the universities here, he tends naturally to find his talents developing along lines, I would say, of architecture, and becomes a great and successful architect in this life. But mind you, John Swift is a new addition, isn't he? He doesn't remember Helena, Krishna, Marcus. He wasn't there. Not his brain. Not his astral body or emotions, not his mental body even, but the soul is the same soul. And the soul's faculties were developed in those lives 1, 2, and 3, stored there, transmuted into faculty, brought down here again as natural talent. And so today, if John Swift, in some experience that he is having, some effort he is making, senses that he's been here before in other places, in other times, it's because as a soul, he is feeling intuitively kinship and awareness of those predecessors of his who have transmitted to him these faculties he has. But John knows that he is adding new touches to this work of the ages, his immortal soul, by his daily life here. And this great work, the soul, will pass from his hand somewhat different, nobler, let us hope, less noble, if things don't go well, to be born tomorrow as Mr. X, let us say. Mr. X, whose parents and even grandparents haven't been conceived. And yet Mr. X, who somehow, not knowing specifically who he was, will nevertheless be indebted to every one of those who have gone on before. Now suppose by chance that Mr. X's name should turn out to be Abraham. Then this immortal soul, who was Marcus, who was Krishna and Helena and John and is now Abraham, this reincarnating intelligence might one day truly observe, before Abraham was, I am. Do you remember that obscure passage in the scriptures? Always puzzled me before I knew about things. True of all of us. Before Perkins was, I am. But because of the limitations imposed upon us by reincarnation, the man doesn't remember, the soul remembers. Now how is that memory transmitted? Memory is here in all of us, in character, in our tendencies, in our associates, in our friends, in our enemies. Remember, they'll teach you, they're your greatest friends, they'll teach you what no one else will. Our talents, our faculties, our capacities. Memory is the explanation for talent and ability. Memory is the only explanation for genius. What other sensible explanation is there? Mozart is a classic example. 4 years of age, there he was playing and writing those little minuets. 7 years of age, he created a symphony. What were you doing at 7 years of age? And me. You see, we have to observe the characteristics of memory over a long period. Suppose I ask you, what were you doing yesterday morning at 9:27 a.m.? I don't remember either. You know why? Because we weren't interested in what we were doing at exactly 9:27 yesterday morning. Suppose I said, what were you doing that same time 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago? Well, how ridiculous can you get? And yet you thinking in those brackets when you're talking about remembering your last life. You see what you're up against when you talk about memory? So we have to get at what it is, how it is we really do remember over long periods of time. Suppose that you fell down and cut your hand very terribly with a knife about 25 years ago one morning, say, at 11:45 in the morning. Suppose you're using that knife and you're using it the wrong way and you have this terrible accident and you cut your hand terribly. Well, you would tend to forget that 11:45 in the morning sooner or later. And maybe one day you couldn't remember really whether it was 25 or 15 years ago. And it might even be that at last you couldn't remember anything about the time. But there's one thing you wouldn't forget. You cut with a knife that way and not this way. Now that's faculty. And it's through faculty that we remember. Faculty and symbolism. Examine the symbols that mean the most to you. That's memory. That's your soul. Remembering. Experience from the past. Very interesting way of knowing. One remembers the past through his ability to read and write, to dance and sing, a knack he might have for using machinery, or some capacity to heal and help, a faculty perhaps for shrewd trading. Everyone remembers the past all the time. If it is memory, after all, that confers the power to generalize from a single experience. You see one thing and you know a whole lot of things because of that one thing. It's memory that makes it possible for us to understand unknown experience, something we haven't even touched in this life, and yet we know all about it. Shakespeare wrote about everything. He didn't have all that experience, and yet how could he write about it so lucidly, so clearly, and so perfectly understandingly? Memory His memory, the propensity of one person toward vice, another toward virtue, the precocity of one child, and the stupidness of another. So you see these limitations of memory. There is memory in sudden friendship, and what about love at first sight? And as I said a while ago, your enemies. You meet them right away, you don't like this person. Why? There's no reasonable reason. Some women have strong masculine traits because of memory of past lives recently spent as a man, and vice versa, feminine men. Does that explain a lot of things? We behold memory in unaccountable fears. I read about the man one day who goes about his business. He has to go up in these tall buildings, never be caught on an elevator. He climbs the stairs. I don't care if it's 25 stories. He wouldn't get off the ground on anything that lifts him up. Why? When it was looked into the past, it was found that this man was hurled from a cliff by his enemies to perish in that screaming fall to the rocks below. And somehow or another, that experience had impinged itself on his present incarnation, and he could remember it in that way. Not the detail, but that fear. So we have explanations for many things if we will take into our thinking and consideration this great law of reincarnation. Now, if the purpose of life is to evolve spiritually, then the reincarnation process is perfectly designed to focus attention, to concentrate the power of character on this present experience. And the function of the brain and the personality is to forget as much as it is to remember. Now, some of us may want this question answered. Is it possible to awaken detailed memory of the past, other lives? Yes, of course. The answer is yes, and any person who investigates with an open mind man's occult powers and the occult side of nature will find the evidence yields convincing testimony that this is so, must be so. There are innumerable records of flashes and detailed memories of the past. There is, for example, a theosophical library of books concerned with the use of trained clairvoyant faculties for investigating the past of other people's lives in the past. There's much information about that strange occult power in nature whereby every living object is photographing its surroundings all the time, and these records are held there eternally in what is technically called the Akashic Records, the memory of nature, God's memory or record of every sparrow's fall, yes, of every hair on your head. And this whole range of nature can be contacted by awakening some of man's latent faculties. There's a science, psychometry, which is the awakening of that particular faculty whereby a person can pick up an object that may have been existing there in some ancient civilization, and by holding it before him can see the pictures of the life that went on around this object in those far-off times. So there are many, many strange faculties that we have latent and will in time and at the proper time come awake as we go on with our evolutionary process toward that period in our evolution when we can use these faculties rightly. But the absence, I would say, of that kind of thing in our lives now means that we must develop the character to be able to live in a time when such faculty is coming alive in everyone. Now, in addition to these and many other ways in which man can get at his past, there is this suddenly popularized stunt of age regression through hypnotism. And I just want to diverge here for a moment to say that the absence of knowledge of the occult nature of man and the occult side of life all around us on the part of these hypnotists and modern psychiatrists, I think, renders hypnotism a highly dubious means of obtaining any authentic information about reincarnation. It isn't generally recognized that hypnotism does subtle violence to the spiritual nature of the soul. And I would say, from the soul's point of view, and in the light of the soul's interests, hypnotism is a kind of spiritual housebreaking. An invasion of a private domain that has great dangers, and except in the hands of skilled and trained men of high ethical procedures and approaches, hypnotism is a dangerous business indeed, certainly for entertainment and any kind of a parlor stunt. If we want to remember the true way, then begin to vivify the bridge between the outer transient self and the inner immortal self. And we begin this by focusing consciousness in the soul, that genius self that comes and goes, that being of mystery, that heavenly man that it comes into appearance from time to time, has been beheld by many a clairvoyant, is glimpsed by the mystics, and has been down through the ages. And it isn't beyond the realm of possibility that any one of us who has given a long enough time to this subject and through long meditation and thought upon it, who might in some quiet and tranquil period be walking along some secluded place and suddenly come upon this vision of the soul in all its glory. And thus he would know forevermore what he really is, never to be confused again. And so one might awaken himself sensitively to the reality of that inner being. And then we would know who we really are. We can do this then by an orderly approach to such experience. And I think that requires the awakening and vivifying of the higher mind. I know of no better way to do this than to begin by observing nature more closely, more carefully, more subtly, to find in your observations the simple and natural confirmation of the universal laws, such as this great law of reincarnation. Now, I could list the examples in nature that show us of reincarnation that illustrate it. But I'm going to deal in these closing moments with one or two objections that I've run upon, objections to reincarnation, and this one because it has a poignancy to it, and I think we ought to deal with it. Some have said, reincarnation destroys the hope of meeting and recognizing our friends and loved ones in the hereafter. Now, if that is the case with any of us, you must see that it is because you haven't truly grasped the nature of reincarnation. We spend in this astral world quite a little period of time, usually, normally, and the normal course of reincarnation is up through the astral world into the heaven world. Everybody goes to heaven in some form or other. There's nobody, hardly anyone, who hasn't got some life of aspiration and love which carries him up to that point. And in any case, we dissociate ourselves from the transient principles down below and become those higher principles before true reincarnation can take place. Anything else is abnormal. That's the normal procedure. And we're there for a long period, hundreds of years, a thousand or more years, and we foregather there as family groups and groups of friends and even national groups. So we're going along together. That objection is answered in that way.